good speaker. You wanted to hear more from him. And what he talked about were all the same problems that we hear about food insecurity, about housing insecurity, about travel insecurity, mm-hmm. you know, where you're allowed to go and not allowed to go. So clearing mm-hmm. the plains was to get all First Nations peoples out of the territory of what was then Canada, nor to get them out of the territory south of the railroad tracks that were going across Canada. So they all had to be north of it. And you ask why?
Why, Doug?
Well, that's what
I asked. Just to help you out there.
I wanted to know why would they do that? I went back to look at this Royal Commission, and it stated right in there, you have to get all of the Indigenous people who are coming out of the United States to get away from the army chasing them and getting into Canadian territory. They don't want them between the border and the rail line.
Oh.
So that's why they wanted to put them north of the rail line. So you look at all of the First Nations reserves across the prairies, they're just about all north of the rail line.
Huh.
And so this is what James Daszak's book, Clearing the Plains. If you haven't read it, go to the library and ask for it. Not you. Anyone else.
No, but Dave. Library?
Yeah.
Anyways. Douglas.
Yes.
Can you stop talking for a minute?
Do that, yes, because
for 30 seconds.
Go.
It's 7:01, mm-hmm. and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
And
it's the rest of Doug. Doug talking.
No. Well, I've got a song.
Telling his stories. What song?
The Legends Project.
Oh, okay.
And it's called The Midnight Strongheart.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. By the Legends Band. And it was actually published in April 1994.
Jeez.
Yeah. Amazing. So here we go.
me bleed, jump through a photograph, make believe. You said I'm sorry when I needed it most. Show up in my dreams just like a ghost.
Hi, this is Chelsea.
And this is Yayi, and we are Twin Flames.
You're listening to our new single, Just Like a Ghost.
Could my hand watch me bleed? Jump through a photograph, make believe. You said I'm sorry when I needed it most. Show up in my dreams just like a ghost.
As a day where we're sowing the seeds of hope for our future. And I know that young people are interested and they want to make change. They want to have a better future for themselves and for future generations.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could borrow a musical instrument free of charge, just like you can borrow books from your local library? We think so too. That's why the Joe Chitlin Memorial Musical Instrument Lending Library, also known as Joe's Mill, has been lending guitars, keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
on Saturday, September 21st, two perennial powerhouse programs in the OUA will go toe-to-toe at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Your Queens Gaels will host the Guelph Griffins. Last year, the Gaels and the Griffins waged war in a classic contest that went down to the wire. Can the Griffins get their revenge, or will the Gaels stay golden at Richardson Stadium? There's only one way to find out, and that's to tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Join us for our pregame show at 2:45 p.m. Kickoff is scheduled for 3. Trust me, folks, you don't want to miss this one.
Did you eat today? If yes, you can thank Ontario Farmland. Ontario Farmland provides local foods and local jobs for millions of Ontarians. But our farmland is under threat. Every day, 319 acres of farmland is lost. Over the past 35 years, 2.8 million acres of farmland have vanished forever. At the Ontario Farmland Trust, we fight to preserve farmland. Visit us at OntarioFarmlandTrust.ca.
G'day, I am CJ the DJ, the host of Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. I hope you can join me every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Remember, put that in, Grad Chat, at 4 p.m. Tuesdays.
Well, Sean, there you go. Grad Chat, great one to listen to and be part of all the time on CFRC. They're on Tuesday nights around 4 o'clock, I believe. And also some other events coming up. Football, you've heard about. And, well, they're live on the air each week with the Queens Gaels.
Football.
Sean, I was just wondering about... what's really happening with, things that we keep talking about here at CFRC and Aboriginal Voices, because over the, we've been talking about all the years past, but I was able to find a piece that we're going to play near the end of the last half hour of the show. Mimi Harvard. And she is, she was with the Ontario Native Women's Association. She was also part of the National Native Women's Association at the time. And she was really interested in getting things done for women and, all the changes. And we also here, you and I worked on a project called Our Stolen Sisters.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, 2013 and 2014,
and like yesterday.
But this interview that I'm going to share with everybody is from our archives, and it was 2014 that Mimi sat down with me and talked about her role in the position she was in, and I know in retrospect now, at that time she was trying to find a place. Because she had finished her PhD in education, and she was trying to find a place for her employment for the future. So Native Women's Association of Canada or Ontario, or were there other places? And over the years, she worked as a professor at Trent University in Native Studies program, and then became the dean. For Native Studies at Trent.
Really? The dean?
She knows Marlene Brand Castellano very well. I think Marlene's given her a lot of great ideas to try out as Mimi went through it. But I listened to this again, and it felt like I was listening to an interview with Mimi that has implications to today, with the only exception being that she's calling for an inquiry into the missing and murdered women. And at the time, Prime Minister Stephen Harper refused to do it, and then he had to eventually, right? And got it started. So we'll see. I don't know exactly when that started and stopped, but there are a lot of recommendations that have come out of that. So we're gonna talk a little bit and then play some new music to bring you into the out of the cassette tapes and the CDs and the we had DAT tapes, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Remember those?
Is that still here?
Yeah, they were digital tape recordings.
Digital audio tape. That's right, DAT.
And we still have a DAT machine sitting in our control room. Oh, I love it.
They're like $3,000-$4,000 at the time.
Oh, they're incredible. So, so I was just wondering who you might like to hear. I was looking through to see who you might be listening to.
I don't know, Doug.
Oh, my goodness. You can't leave me in the lurch.
So many choices.
Uh-huh.
So little time. Little time, right?
Well, here's one of the oldies. Navigate.
Oh, okay.
Want to try that?
Certainly.
And, Running Like a River with Logan Statz. We'll try that right now. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll go to Mimi, or yeah, my interview from the archives.
All right.
Okay. Good. All right. We're all set, Sean. I do see it going. Yeah. Now.
My neighbor, do yourself the favor. When the words fall down, you're looking like a clown. Ain't no one gonna say you, they'll take back what they gave you. It's like that, like that. So when you want the truth, you had enough of Dr. Seuss. You've been so tight, but your love is so loose. No advice to be given, it's all a part of living. It's like that, like that. Don't cover up this hour, don't duck it, cower. It'll be your longest hour. Face the music, don't abuse it, deal. Cause it's real, no time to buy a steal. Let yourself be. You'll heal. Set your course, navigate. Be real. Navigate. I see you don't need comprehend, so give me your ear, my friend. I have advice to lend and ways of life to mend. Rhythmic syncopation, my occupation requires your concentration as I navigate my translation. Telling you what I'm knowing, if you don't like where you're going or the road the life's showing, rock the boat. Start rowing, face what you're fearing when you feel the end is near. And I'm talking, you're hearing, stop, easy ride. Start steering, try to be an original, not another dupe. Be an individual, the leader of the group. Don't just look, try to see. Don't just act, try to be. A thinker, a player, a writer, a stayer, a maker, a buyer, but not a liar. Live by a creed, a model for your creed. Stop, easy riding. Set your course, navigate. Rock the boat, start rowing. Face where you're going. Navigate. Set your course. Yeah. can be a game, but your hands are dealt the same. You gotta learn how to play, when to fold, when to stay. Joker's wild, the deck's stacked and piled. If somebody calls your bluff, poker face won't be enough. It's like that, it's like that. Life choices can be hard, unless you draw a good trump card. No matter what the crowd's doing, it's you. You should be true to one time. You'll be faceless, a royal flush that is aceless. You could be king for a day, then have it taken away. It's a price you have to pay, it's like that. Wanna find your inner wealth, navigate your life yourself. Set your course for mental health. Remember, life is but a stage. You've got the power to write each page of your script in all your glory. Navigate the course for your own life story. Face what you're fearing when you feel the end is near. Navigate. Set your course. Let yourself be. I'm talking, you're hearing stuff. Easy ride. Start steering. Navigate. It's time.
You're running like a little dove. We have a special guest today here at CFRC, and thank you for coming in, Mimi. And our guest is Mimi Harvard, who is, let's see if I get it all right here. You're the president of the Ontario Native Women's Association and the vice president of the...
The Native Women's Association of Canada.
Okay, thank you. And welcome to our project today.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Now, it's going to be a little interesting for me to go through today's talk because I've been meeting with some people, family members and university people, university students, and you're in a different role than all the other people. Our project today is looking at missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. Mm-hmm. And from your association's point of view, first, mm-hmm. not your personal one, but working through what the Ontario Native Women's Association is doing. What do you see as the major problem with any government going forward trying to do an inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women?
Well, as we've been working through this process, initially when we started the research, when we started the work, nobody believed us. I mean, nobody even understood that there was a problem, and we really spent the first few years just trying to educate everybody so that people even understood that this is a problem, that this is a crisis. And what I found most interesting recently was even with the RCMP and, you know, the comments that were made that our data, we didn't have hard data, we didn't have access to actual records, which we absolutely admit because of the position we're in, we don't have access to all of that data. We were going by simply what we could even find in the media, which, as we all know, is just the tip of the iceberg because there are so many more Indigenous women out there who don't make the headlines. And so we knew it was worse than we thought. So what we found most interesting was when the RCMP said they were going to go back and actually do the research and check the actual databases and get back to us, you know, of course, because our work was just anecdotal. And when they came back, they found it was almost 1,200 missing and murdered women compared to the 600 names we had managed to find. And while I was shocked, appalled, and really very deeply saddened by that number, it did prove what we had always known and believed, which was that the problem was much worse than even we knew. So this is something we've had to work on for a long time, was just getting larger society and the institutions that are supposed to be protecting our women, protecting our people, to even see the light that there is a problem here and look into it more. Unfortunately, at the federal level, there seems to be a political stance that very early on, when we were calling for the national inquiry and starting to get a lot of international attention into this situation, Prime Minister Harper very clearly said he would not ever support a national inquiry, and he has stuck very strongly to that position. And it's interesting that now we have the premiers of every province and territory in this country on side. They are supporting, they understand and firmly believe and are supporting us in the call for a national inquiry. And I just find it completely incomprehensible how you could have the leaders of every province supporting the call for a national inquiry, and yet the leader of the country, which is no greater than the sum of its provinces and territories, saying no, they absolutely will not pursue that or allow it. And I mean, reasons they cite, such as, wouldn't you rather have the dollar spent right now on the ground in the community? Which I understand, and especially as we do run a lot of community-based programs, I understand if you are, they're always underfunded, we're always in danger of closing the doors, always have waiting lists, and can never meet the need. A lot of the grassroots level organizations, there is that temptation to jump at, yes, we would, because we do obviously always need that money at the community level. But the problem is, if we don't have a nationwide, a really strategic approach into looking at what's happening so that we can make sure that those few piddly little dollars that we do get are spent effectively and appropriately, then we're never really going to address the issue. And one of the things that the families are concerned with is a national inquiry would actually allow us access to, you know, police records, to the kinds of sources of data, the kinds of sources of information that would give the insight into what the real problems are here, you know, where the women are being made vulnerable, where women are falling through the cracks, whether it's policies, whether it's not following the policies. We would be able to see some of those things come forward and make some really good, clear recommendations and changes so that we can stop this crisis of missing and murdered women, of our women being stolen from our communities.
Okay, so you've given me a lot there to think about, which is good. So we're going to go at it from three perspectives. The first one are the issues. What are the specific issues that communities need to look at when dealing with missing Aboriginal women or missing women in their community?
One of the things that actually was quite recently, somebody took me aside and said, you know, why do you keep calling them missing and murdered women? And I said, well, I don't understand. And she said, well, why do you keep saying missing? That's too soft. And she says, you know, that my car keys are missing, or my wallet goes missing, maybe even my cat goes missing. She says, but these women, they're not just missing. She said, like, these women, they were stolen. They were stolen from our communities, stolen from our families. And I really, really had to stop and think about that. And we said, you know, like, well, explain why is the problems we have with sex trafficking here in Canada. Unfortunately, well over 90% of the victims, those who are being trafficked here in Canada, are domestic. They are from Canada. They're not coming in from foreign countries. This isn't something that's happening far overseas. This is something happening right here in our own borders. And the women being trafficked are Canadian, and a largely disproportionate amount are Indigenous women and girls. For example, when they did a study in Winnipeg of the 400 children who had been exploited in the city of Winnipeg that year, I believe 80% were Indigenous. And that's absolutely appalling. And these are children who are being exploited, sexually exploited in the streets. And 76% of those who were being exploited had been in the care of the Children's Aid Society. So there's a very clear connection between child welfare intervention and eventually being on the streets in the sex trade and trafficking. And something that has recently been a very big debate is the prostitution debate, especially here in Ontario. And we were actually criticized for coming out, you know, wanting to have sex trade exiting programs, and we were criticized for not supporting supposedly the rights of Indigenous women to be involved in the sex trade. And we said, you know, it was something that really got turned around. And it's not that we are not supporting a woman's right, regardless of her ethnicity or background, to choose what to do with her body. Our concern is that here in Canada, the average age that an Indigenous woman or an Indigenous girl enters into the sex trade is 13. And when my grade 5 math, I have to employ these skills, you know how averages work, that for every 15, 16-year-old to have that 13 average, that means there were just as many 9, 10, 11-year-olds to get that average. And that just absolutely breaks my heart when I hear, you know, women talking about our children, young as 8 years old, being approached by sex trade recruiters, by traffickers, when they're in the parks or when they're walking home from schools. And I mean, those are children. So our young girls, it's not that they're just gone missing, they disappeared somewhere. They are being stolen to be exploited in the sex trade. In Thunder Bay, we have a real concern with the international freighters, where women are going out to these freighters and, you know, they're on international waters and they're gone. They're never seen again. And this is a real concern for us. So it's very complicated, and that's where our particular approach is really starting to change the thinking around this subject. And one of the other things that recently in an RCMP study that they did, the myth out there is that Indigenous women are going missing and being murdered because they're high risk, because they're vulnerable, because either they're doing drugs or they're involved in the sex trade, or, you know, any number of the sort of prejudice stereotypes that are out there. A lot of the families that I've talked to have said that when they initially went to report their loved one missing or went to the police stations, that initially the response was, well, that's, you know, one less drug addict we have to worry about, or one less welfare mom that my taxes have to pay for, and a lot of really derogatory, degrading comments and responses. Or that, you know, more recently what's happened is they're probably just off partying and they'll come back and, you know, come back in a few days if they don't return by Monday or Tuesday. And those crucial first few days, especially if it's sex trafficking, a lot of the girls said that they were moved from the city within the first 24 hours. And then they just keep moving them from city to city across Canada. And because they never really know where they are, they can't escape. So it's something that lack of response is shocking. And for example, when Maisie Ojig and Shannon Alexander went missing in the Ottawa area, teenage girls, and the next morning their parents realized that they weren't at Maisie's house or Shannon's house, but they found the bags, their wallets, their cell phones, all of their stuff was there. The response initially was they were labeled as runaways. And so the response is very different than somebody simply, you know, missing as they see it. But what concerns me is around the same time, there was a young boy around the Barrie area, and he was a known runaway. He had had a fight with his parents, same age, and because they had taken away his Xbox over some issue, and he ran away. I'm sure you remember the case. And this is not in any way to degrade that loss, because, in fact, that was absolutely tragic. The point I'm making is that when that boy went missing, even though they knew he was a runaway because he had had this fight with his parents, I remember the headlines. It was all over the news. It was all over the TV all night. Like, hundreds of people, police, rescue, everybody out combing the railway lines and searching the fields for that young man. And at the same time, these two girls, because they're Native girls, go missing in Ottawa, and their parents are told, well, they're runaways, or, you know, there were days passed by before anybody even started looking, or they argue over whose job it is to start looking. And it's that kind of differential response that allows our girls to slip through the cracks in those first few crisis moments when those girls could be found. Nobody's responding appropriately. And that's the kind of thing that we're hoping, you know, if we can see some actual evidence of this, like really start to expose that, then that we will get the changes in the policies, the changes in the response, and the changes in the attitudes, so that when one of our girls is stolen, people go looking right away.
And Mimi, you're talking about a very serious issue that's going to have an impact on all family members, not just the parents, because there are siblings who have sisters who have been stolen. And in this project that we're doing, Our Stolen Sisters, we're listening to the voices from the community. And your voice is very important, because you're the president of the Ontario Native Women's Association, and also you're connected with the National Native...
The Native Women's Association of Canada.
Thank you. But what I'm seeing is that there is not enough conversation in the collective communities, the smaller communities. Not that the federal government is just looking at this as a justice issue and a prison issue, and that's all they're going to do. Although we're going to talk a little bit more about strategic planning. So what strategic plan do you have as an Ontario Native Women's Association to bring this forward and in the media, but also to try and make changes in communities?
Exactly. So this is something we have been doing, that sort of multifaceted approach, where one of the biggest steps we've had to do is at the community level, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women has been really just Canada's dirty little secret. I mean, it has been very conveniently swept under the rugs. I mean, we're very good to point the fingers and to send aid when women are being oppressed overseas, but just ignore what's happening in a community 5 minutes down the road, right in our own backyards, right in our urban centers in Toronto and Ottawa and Winnipeg. And so that's one of the biggest things, has been just starting to have that awareness. And over the 10 years that I've been working in this area specifically, I have seen a lot of community awareness on this. What went from, you know, vigils, one vigil And on October 4th, they hold the vigils for the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. And, you know, at the last count, there was over 100 communities had vigils across the country on the same. And, you know, hundreds of people coming out to those vigils on October 4th. So just to see that growth of community awareness, we have reached that point, I think, where the government can't deny anymore that this is a problem. And the recent RCMP report, in fact, proved our point and, in fact, bettered our argument. So they can't pretend that this is just anecdotal, that this is just urban myth. This is, in fact, a genuine crisis and a tragedy. And when Stephen Harper came out with his comment about, you know, this is a crime, not a sociological phenomenon, I said, I agree. This is a crime. This is a tragedy, and we need to address it, not just lock up and punish if you find somebody, but the real crime is in letting it continue to happen. And that's what's going to happen if we don't have the kind of national inquiry to really understand where the women are slipping through the cracks, where they're being made vulnerable. And that's, you know, one of the points that our elders in our community have said is that, you know, saying that these women ended up in this situation because they were at risk, because they had high-risk lifestyles, is ludicrous. If you look at a lot of our communities where our women were born at risk, a lot of our First Nations, they're living in communities where they don't have homes, they don't have enough housing for all of their community members, they don't have hydro, they don't have clean water, they don't have proper sewer, you know, schools without a roof, communities without schools, without books, without resources. I mean, our people were born at risk. So to say that this was somehow the result of a lifestyle choice that they made is just absolutely ridiculous. These circumstances were created, and they are now experiencing the effects of living in that kind of circumstance.
So what, to give our listeners some hope, okay,
this is what really... What are we supposed to do?
No, that's the whole idea of this project is to get the details, get the passion from the people who are talking about it and who are experiencing all of this. Because for many, many listeners right now, you've brought out some very, very important points. So what hope could we give to our listeners and actions that they might take? Just looking at this issue with trying to get, say, the federal government to change its stand on this issue. Because as you were talking, I'm thinking, okay, the issue of doing an inquiry is not just going to be about why is this one individual not in our community anymore, but it looks like you're going into all of the social aspects, water, housing, employment, and many, many other things in building a community. So what little ideas do you have and what really big ideas do you have?
Okay, so from a community perspective, one of the best things we can do is, you know, no more silence on this issue. Everybody needs to be aware of this issue. And a lot of times when we have one presentation somewhere, people can contact just Google the Native Women's Association of Canada. And on that site, they have the Faceless Dolls Project, which if you contact the Native women, they will send, you know, one of the staff out with these faceless dolls that represent all of the many, you know, what society sees as essentially, you know, faceless Indigenous women who have gone missing or been murdered. And they will come and sit with, whether it's a classroom or your community group or your union meeting or your church auxiliary meeting, whatever it is, get a bunch of people together, have them come out and learn about this, understand about it so that we know what's going on. Because the more people in Canadian society that are aware of this, who speak out and say that this is a tragedy, that we need to stop this, that we need to understand this, and that we need to have that inquiry, that kind of social pressure, you know, talk to your MP. There's elections coming up. Talk to the representatives and ask what their position is on this. What are they prepared to do? Write a letter to your MP, to your local provincial representative, and really start having those conversations. It's the fact that we've been, the government, that everybody's been able to sweep it under the rug and not talk about it that has allowed this to happen. So the more we get people talking about it, the more it's coming to light, the more we're going to be likely to have action. And so that's something that the Faceless Dolls Project can come out and have community members, because a lot of people just really don't understand what's going on and don't understand why it's distinctly different or how it's different for Indigenous women and girls here in Canada. And it is connected to, you know, that long history of colonization, of racism, of sexism, which makes circumstances and responses and the treatment of Indigenous women here in Canada very distinctly different than it is for Aboriginal peoples or for other women. And, you know, when those two combine, it creates, that's what's creating this problem that we have. And one of the things they do is on October 4th every year, they have vigils. So again, you can get involved, host a vigil in your area, and get the word out there. That's, we've gone, you know, hundreds of communities now on October 4th have vigils where the women come out and they march in the streets. And again, it's gone from having one vigil to all across the country. And so that kind of raising an awareness is what is starting to make the difference in this situation. We are politically, we are at the Native Women's Association working with, as we've said, you know, we have the support at the provincial level from all of the provinces and territories. We are planning on having a meeting to discuss how we can strategically look at this problem and start to make a difference, because there are so many factors that play into creating this situation. And we cannot have something where each ministry, for example, in Ontario, whether it's the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Housing, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Employment and Training, you know, all of these things, when you start to work with them, you realize that each one says, well, that's outside of our mandate, we don't do that. And then you go to the next one, and you tend to get that same sort of response, because people's lives don't fit into nice little square boxes of somebody's mandate. And it always spills over the edges and connects and is across several different mandates in several different ministries. So one of the things we did was we said, okay, instead of us running around to every different ministry and everybody saying, no, we don't do that, we've invited the ministries to come and sit at one table. And we had an interministerial table where at last count, I think we were at least up to 11 different ministries came and sat at the table and said, what are we going to do to address this? And that was absolutely foundational and phenomenal to start having that kind of cooperative approach, rather than just saying that's not within my mandate, saying, well, what can I do to contribute to being part of the solution here, rather than just ignoring the problem. And that has really turned the tide here in Ontario in terms of getting a lot more support, even with the upcoming Aboriginal Children and Youth Strategy that is looking very, very promising to make a difference. So what would be really nice is, you know, if we can start getting some of our federal representatives to have that kind of willingness to come and just sit and listen and understand. And then, exactly, there's, If they can deliberately ignore it, then they don't have to address it. But so that's really, if every community member, if they start hearing about it in their grocery stores, in their local towns, at the hockey games or the ball games, then they can't ignore it anymore. And that's what's going to make the difference at the federal level in terms of changing the approach and the response to this issue.
Mimi Harvard, thank you very much for being part of this project. And what I would like to do is leave the last word to you for our listeners, and what can they do? You've already given us some suggestions there, but what kind of hope is there for our younger people?
Well, this is something that I really struggle with, because as a mother of three daughters, I have to admit, at one point last summer we were traveling, and my 10-year-old, she looks at me and she asks and she says, you know, what is all this missing and murdered stuff? And I had to talk to her. I mean, they hear, their little ears perk up on everything they're not supposed to hear. And so I explained to her and what was going on and the high rates. And she says, but Mommy, you know, we're Native. And I said, yeah. And then she says, and I'm a girl. And I says, yes. And so she looks, I mean, you can see her mind just clicks. And she says, but does that mean I'm in danger? And it broke my heart, because I thought, my instinct is to just say, of course not, you know, I will protect you. But I know that as an Indigenous person, as a young Indigenous woman, young girl, everything I do points to the fact that she is in danger. And I can't just lock her up in my house forever. So that's why doing all of this is so important. So on the days when I feel like I don't want to have to talk about this anymore, because in fact there are events when we've had these conversations and had these community awareness events, and a number of women from the audience come forward and say, you know, my sister was murdered, or my cousin or my mom is still missing. And it happens again and again and again, to the point where sometimes I feel like I just want to pull the blankets over my head and not do this again for another day. But you realize that's part of it is you can't, because there are those young girls out there, and we don't want them to be living in fear, feeling like they can't leave their communities or their homes because they're going to be endangered. I mean, there are so many smart, brave, strong young women coming up who are, you know, in the schools right now, in the universities right now, and we want them to feel that courage that they can go out to walk to the corner store to get a Pepsi or a bag of chips and be safe, you know, not be feeling that they're afraid to go out there. So that's why it's so important that we don't give up the struggle, that every community member can make a difference, even if it's just by learning about it yourself and then spreading the conversation to your family, your friends. That's how it gets out to everybody. And once everybody's talking about it, it can't be ignored anymore. And that's no matter how small it is, even if it's just talking to your best friend about it, and then to somebody who feels ambitious and wants to talk to your MP, that's great too. You know, everybody has different levels of time, but just learning about it yourself. Go out there and actively, you know, look it up, understand what's going on. That's what's going to make the difference. And that's what's going to help those young girls that are out there right now, that hopefully by the time they're my age, by the time they're grown up, they won't be having the same conversation. So we can hope.
Mimi Miigwech.
Thank you, Mimi Miigwech, for being here.
Porch light on just in case. Open that door swings and I see your face. And I, oh, naive
enough. And I keep your photograph to this day, wishing and hoping that you're okay. And I, I'm missing you now.
I'm a bitter on my rave. Kids are on a till little rave.
Was the same. Love remains. All this hurts inside me. Call your name to this day. Wish you were home beside me.
We've left your bedroom in its place. Posters and memories unerased. And I,
standing in the doorway, I hold back my tears. Seems just like yesterday, although it's been years. And I'm missing you now.
I never know how to
was the same, love remains, all this hurts inside me. Call your name to this day, wish you were home beside me.
on just in case. Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I I'll lay you around. I leave the porch light on just in case. Open that door, swings, and I see your face. And I
your heart.